Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Massey Bambara, North Bay Market President of Bank of America, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your chair for today's program. We also welcome our listeners on radio and television and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today we are pleased to present the Walter Hoadley Annual Economic Forecast, named in honor of the club's late past president and longtime board member, Dr. Walter Hoadley. Dr. Hoadley also served most notably as chief economist and vice president of the Bank of America. Today's program is sponsored by the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America. Today's program will feature two distinguished speakers with distinctive viewpoints. Dr. Christina Romer, professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley and former chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. And Mr. Keith Hennessy, who teaches at the Stanford University Graduate School of Business and Stanford Law School, and served as director of the National Economic Council under President George W. Bush. Keith Hennessy served as both director of the National Economic Council and as assistant to President Bush for economic policy. As director of the National Economic Council during the 2008 financial crisis, Mr. Hennessy was at the center of one of the most volatile times in American history. He was a senior White House economic advisor, where he coordinated the design of the president's policies on taxes, health care, pensions, energy, and financial markets and institutions, among others. Mr. Hennessy has spent more than 15 years in economic policy roles for senior elected officials. Before his time in the White House, he worked on Capitol Hill for more than 7 years as economics advisor to former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. Since leaving the White House, Mr. Hennessy has been a television commentator and started a blog, which was named one of the top 25 economic blogs by the Wall Street Journal. He also served as a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Mr. Hennessy holds an undergraduate degree from Stanford and master's degree in public policy from Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. As chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors from January 2009 until September 2010, Dr. Christina Romer was one of the four economics principals who met with President Obama daily to design and guide the administration's response to the Great Recession. Dr. Romer played a key role in the administration's macroeconomic policy, reform of the financial system, healthcare reform, and budget policy. An expert in economic history and macroeconomics, Dr. Romer is a leading scholar on the causes of the Great Depression and the impact of monetary and fiscal policy. In addition to her current role as the Class of 1957 Garth B. Wilson Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, she is also co-director of the program in monetary economics at the National Bureau of Economics Research. Dr. Romer is a regular contributor to the New York Times Economic View column and a contributing editor for Bloomberg Television. Dr. Romer holds an undergraduate degree from the College of William and Mary and a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Today, Dr. Romer and Mr. Hennessy will be in conversation with Anna Mock, Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and partner at Deloitte & Touche. Please welcome Dr. Christina Romer, Keith Hennessy, and Anna Mock.
Thank you, Massey, for your introductions. Last evening, I was home preparing for today and sharing with my 12-year-old daughter, Jordan, both Dr. Romer and Mr. Hennessy's background. She had two observations. You have someone who worked for a Republican president and then another one who worked for a Democratic president, and you have Stanford and Cal there. How are you ever going to get them to actually be in agreement? And I said, well, actually, they're not going to necessarily be in agreement, but they will definitely share their views. And they may have different views, and I hope we will have that. Hopefully that leads to a lot of enlightening conversation that we'll have in the room and also good questions from the audience. So with that, we'll start off really with some of the big events of the week. We had earlier in the week the inauguration of President Obama for a second term. Getting into Obama and clearly the view, there's a lot of questions on how he's doing and what the administration is going to do given what's happened in the recent election. So, Dr. Romer, if you can share some views, given you've worked for the president in your previous role, of how is the administration doing relative to the economy?
So, you know, certainly what is true is that the American economy has been through a very rough 5 years, and President Obama has been president for 4 of those. So it was certainly a baptism by fire in terms of what he faced coming in. Yeah, I think the administration has taken some incredibly important economic policies, everything from the Recovery Act that I think played a key role in helping us to turn the corner, to health care reform, which I think is going to be very important going forward for the health of the economy, to financial regulatory reform, all those things. So I think he's accomplished a great deal. Unfortunately, there's still a whole lot more to do, and I think the big issue looming, well, there's so many big issues, everything from immigration reform to gun control. We got a sense from his inaugural address of the things that he definitely wants to tackle. But the one he's not going to be able to avoid is the fiscal situation, that we have a lot of forcing events that has to happen between the debt ceiling and what are we going to do with the sequester, you know, the money that the government spending that's supposed to be cut. Those are issues that he's going to have to face, and I think much more important is the very large, long-run budget deficit that I think all of us want our policymakers to come together and figure out how we're going to deal with it. So I think that, unfortunately, is going to have to be front and center in the next year of coming up with a solution to that, and I sure hope it is.
Let's see. I think first thing to just remind ourselves of is that the impact of a president on the short-term macroeconomy is almost always exaggerated. The president can have a big impact on the economy in the medium term and the long run, largely through influencing Congress. And while the Fed has got a dial that they can turn to have a much bigger short-term effect, we immediately look to the White House and we say, what are you going to do about the economy right now? And Dr. Romer and I would have to go on TV at various points in time and talk about the jobs report and what was going to happen over the course of the next month. And the thing that's so frustrating is you know that, in fact, not much that you're doing actually has a direct linkage to what's going to happen over the course of the next month. But I think it is interesting how the debate has shifted. 4 years ago, if you were talking about the economy, it was entirely about the short-term situation. Now the economy is still weak. It is growing slowly. But it is clearly a heck of a lot healthier than it was 4 years ago. And yet none of the discussion now is about the short-term macro picture. It's entirely about the medium-term fiscal picture. And unfortunately, I don't see us making any significant progress on that, frankly, anytime in at least the next 2 years. I think they're at a stalemate, and I think it's going to sort of be ugly arguments with little progress over the next couple of years.
Let me jump in for a second. Because you said you wanted us to debate. So I actually think the focus has not all changed to the medium-term deficit. And, in fact, I think the reason I think it's sort of front and center is precisely because it has to be part of the discussion of do you do anything more on jobs. So I do think the president cares deeply about the fact that we still have an unemployment rate just slightly below 8%, that is an unbelievable tragedy. But I think realistically, if you're going to do more infrastructure spending or you're going to make the kind of investments we need to make in education that might put people back to work now and make us more productive in the future, the only way you ever get a Congress to go along with you is if you also say, let's make this as part of a package to deal with all those other long-run fiscal things. So I think, in my view, dealing with the medium-term fiscal situation in some sense is making space to do the things you need to do now to get more short-term recovery.
Okay, except that the...
Poor Anna.
No, it's good.
But you want this, right?
I want this, exactly.
Look, to move the needle, if you're pulling on the fiscal policy lever and you're trying to have a short-term impact, you've got to pull pretty hard. In 2008, we actually, President Bush proposed and Congress quickly enacted what we then called a fiscal stimulus bill. And on the right of the aisle, it was not You know, it was not forbidden to actually call it that. It was a bipartisan bill. It was amazing that we had bipartisanship at that time. But it was $150 billion. It was $150 billion pushed out over about an 18-month period. And we figured that that was probably at least the smallest size that you needed to be to move the needle on GDP. The Obama folks came in. They did something significantly bigger. And they did that in part because the macro picture was far worse. The additional infrastructure spending and increased government spending that's being talked about right now is too small and too slow if you buy into the idea that more government spending is going to give a short-term GDP kick. Then they're not doing enough of it. I'm skeptical about that. I wouldn't be doing that set of policies. But if you actually want to do the short-term kick, you've got to do something that is, I don't want to say an order of magnitude, but several times larger. Saying we're going to increase highway spending by another $100 billion over the next 2 years isn't going to give you the short-term kick. I also think that it's infeasible to imagine that with a Republican House, you're actually going to get significantly increased government spending in any context. But I think those are sort of two separable questions. So I think it's legislatively infeasible, and even if it were legislatively feasible, I don't think it's big enough to move the GDP needle enough to make a significant impact.
So what would move the needle?
I don't think there is much I don't think there's much in terms of government actions. I won't surprise folks here. I am concerned about the drags that continue to be imposed on the private sector. I think that some of the uncertainty that we had, regulatory uncertainty, has been eliminated with the reelection of President Obama. There's now not a question as to whether or not the Affordable Care Act is going to move forward. We know it's going to move forward. We know there's not going to be an effort to repeal it. Now you're just left with the regulatory uncertainty about how quickly are the states going to implement the exchanges, what is CMS and HHS going to do on the details of that. There's now no question that Dodd-Frank is not only the law, but will stay in place for at least another couple few years. So at least that dimension of policy uncertainty has been eliminated, but still the question of how are all the regulatory agencies going to do their work is going to create uncertainty and cause a drag. So I'm worried about policy drags. That shouldn't surprise anyone here.
But we can come back to this. So you were saying, right, that it's not plausible to do enough infrastructure spending. But if you look across the Atlantic to Europe, exactly what we're seeing happening is exactly the opposite of a dramatic fiscal contraction. And I think that's part of what we're trying to avoid with a sensible discussion about the budget deficit going forward. How do you make progress on that? How do you put spending in some key areas? But I think most important, how do you avoid doing a tremendous amount of austerity, say in 2013 or 2014, which would absolutely be devastating.
Yeah, and part of this is the old joke about you give someone a sentence and you say, I worry most about the blank economy and I'll let the blank take care of itself. And you ask them to fill in short-term and long-term. And if you are left or right, you tend to often focus on different priorities. And what we've got here, to a certain extent, is a short-term, long-term trade-off, which is, you know, the Obama team increased government spending by $850, $860 billion. They made an argument that that was going to increase GDP in the short run. And then there's all sorts of arguments about the counterfactual and about how effective that actually was. The one thing that we know for certain is that it increased the budget deficit by $860 billion. And so there's a long-term cost. And I think that part of what's happened now, part of it is because the economy is starting to heal itself, and part of it is just a new policy focus, is there is more focus on the medium-term fiscal problems relative to a few years ago when it was all about what is the government going to do and what's going to happen right now.
And you would view that as positive, that we should be.
I am principally concerned. I am more skeptical about the government's ability to goose GDP in the short run, and I tend to think that there are often negative consequences to doing so, and I am very concerned about the what we used to call the long-term fiscal problem and what we now call the medium-term fiscal problem.
So let me just say, I care about both of them. I think that's in fact, I think any policymaker has to care about both the short run and how much are people suffering today and the long run. And I actually think they're often interrelated. So, you know, one of the things we've worried so much about is if unemployment stays high for a very long period of time, that tends to hurt unemployment into the future because people lose their attachment to the labor force, their job skills. So I think these two things are related. And exactly what I was saying is I think one of the places we have the biggest agreement is about the long-run budget deficit and how we have to really take serious measures to get that under control. But I think that's important not just for the long run, but for today. I think it does increase confidence today. I think it does open up space today to do some good investments today. The other thing, in terms of what can government do, I think we shouldn't leave out the Federal Reserve. You said the Federal Reserve had a dial. They absolutely do. One of the most positive developments, I think, over the last, say, 4 or 5 months has been that the Fed has sort of woken up again. They were very active during the crisis. They kind of dialed back for a few years there. And starting in September, I think, started to say, okay, we're gonna do more and try to be more helpful. And I think we're seeing signs of that, and I think it is very important.
Can I hit one point on short-term, long-term? And I'm not suggesting that Dr. Romer has made this argument because I've never heard her say it. I do hear the argument frequently that because we still have short-term economic weakness, we can't make changes to our medium-term fiscal policy. Oh gosh, you can't start to cut the entitlements that much because if you do, we'll weaken the recovery and things will be really bad. And I think what that does is that makes the mistake of conflating the date for implementation versus the date for agreement. You and I could reach agreement now on a deal to restructure our entitlement spending program, and I'll tell you what, if it solves the medium and long-term fiscal picture, I'll let you pick any start date you want. You can pick 4 years from now, you can pick 5 years from now, whatever date you want that gets you past the point where you're concerned about the short-term impact. Because if we're talking about restructuring those entitlement programs, I don't particularly care about the first few years. So I'm willing to let you pick that date to just take that argument off the table. But instead what happens is that a lot of folks left of center say we can't in fact even negotiate the agreement on the long-term solution until the economy has recovered. And I just think that's a false argument.
All right, that's Paul Krugman, not me. So I think both of us actually would say, you know, I understand where Krugman is coming from, but I think both of us disagree with that. The sense, I think one of the most frightening thoughts is, oh, we'll let the next generation deal with a long-term budget deficit. And, you know, the key thing is it gets harder the longer you put off dealing with it. So I am with you completely that making those decisions now, I think, is very important. I think where you differ from a lot of people on the right is being very reasonable about when you phase it in. So much of the last couple of years has all been about we absolutely have to get the deficit down this year or we have to cut spending this year. And in a vulnerable economy, I think that is dangerous. And I think it's much more important to make the hard decisions. You know, the buzz phrase is to make your fiscal consolidation backloaded, so to kick in gradually over time. I think that's absolutely the right policy for an economy like we have that's still vulnerable.
So talking about some of the short-term decisions, and we talked a little bit about the fiscal cliff. So are we going to be able to pay our bills this year, given some of the debates that's been going on and also given your view about really nothing can really happen in 2 years, in the next 2 years?
Define pay our bills.
Will the federal government be able to honor our debts this summer?
Okay, so that's a question about the debt limit.
The debt limit, yes.
I think so, yeah. I think the most likely scenario is that a few months from now, Congress repeats what it just did, which is there's a lot of huffing and puffing, and then I think they do another extension. I don't think it's a long-term, a one-year or two-year extension. I think it's a 6 months or a 9 months extension, and I think the fiscal conservatives try to get some kind of concession on spending in exchange for that. And that's not ideal, but I think that that is probably the most likely scenario. I had an op-ed in the Journal, I guess it was last week, urging Republican members to vote for an increase in the debt limit, but at the same time to be demanding that the budget process move forward and that you start to get some spending. I think that as much as there is an increased liquidity risk from these short-term debt limit extensions, we also have a tremendous solvency risk as a fiscal matter if you don't have a forcing event. Because right now, given the polarization in Washington, by far the most likely scenario is that nothing happens for 4 years on the medium-term deficit picture. If that's the case, you've got to decide, are you willing to live with that? I'm sure there are factions within the Greek government that would love nothing more than for the Germans to just give them enough liquidity to go for 5 years and never check up on them. Right? But in fact, a creditor doesn't do that. Or if you're a creditor of a firm that's gone bankrupt or going bankrupt, if you come in with late money, you say, you know what, I'm going to give you money to keep you going for the next quarter or two, and I want regularly check-ins, and I want you to set metrics, and I want to see what you're doing. I look on the debt limit as the only tool that the spending conservatives have right now to try to create that accountability, to because otherwise we just keep spending.
But you would see just very incremental movement.
I think that's the most likely scenario, unless somehow a miraculous deal appears to cut spending by $1 or $2 trillion over the next decade. And I can't see where the votes are to do that right now.
So, you know, the debt limit is such a strange thing. I think we are about the only country in the world that we vote once on whether to spend the money and once on whether to pay the bill. And that just doesn't make sense. And so I think I'm probably going to disagree with you here. Keith actually was talking earlier about an episode back in 2008 where the banks were in trouble. The Bush administration had gone to Congress and said, listen, we need to put capital into banks. That's the hated TARP legislation. And he described very rightly of how Congress first turned it down, then the stock market plummeted, and Congress said, okay, we changed our mind. And I think that may be part of what we're seeing on the debt ceiling. Is the last fight over the debt ceiling back in the summer of 2011 turned out to be a terrible self-inflicted wound for the American economy. We saw consumer confidence plummet. Our debt got downgraded. I think that's part of why I think even Republicans who care very much about spending are nervous to use that as a bargaining chip again. Just precisely, we saw how damaging bringing into question the creditworthiness of the American government was. So I'm hopeful that we won't keep fighting over this, that we'll have the right fight, which is what should spending be, what should we do about the deficit, and not should we pay the bill, because I think that's a terrible
one. And there's a very interesting question here about whether, in retrospect, whether Republicans leveraging the debt limit in the summer of 2011 to get a bill that cut spending by $1 to $2 trillion going forward, whether in fact that was worth it. Because what they did was they introduced liquidity risk, right, by saying, hey, if you don't cut spending, we're not going to vote for a debt limit increase. And it worked. And as a result, they got the president to agree to cut government spending by a very significant amount. Now, would you like that negotiation had resulted from not having made that threat? Absolutely. But the question is, do you think it actually would have occurred? And so there's a difference. Now, I would never be one to advocate that Congress should not increase the debt limit. I absolutely think that they should. And when this came up in the summer of 2011, I wrote that, and I put it in the pages of National Review, which is, you know, only read by the conservatives. And I was arguing against those who were saying, look, let's start to create a cash flow crisis, a cash crunch. Absolutely the wrong thing to do. But Congress also has the ability to decide what they attach to that debt limit increase legislation. And I think it's completely appropriate for Congress to attach spending cuts to that. I use the metaphor, if you give your teenage kid a credit card, and your kid goes and just blows through the credit limit, right? You don't, as some folks on the right were saying, you don't stop paying the credit card bill. You pay the bill because those obligations have already been incurred and you have a legal and, I would argue, a moral obligation to pay your bill. But at the same time, you don't let the kid keep the credit card and just keep spending. What do? You do two things. You pay the past bills, and then you sit down and you say, we're going to institute some discipline and we're going to cut your future spending. And that's what I was advocating that Republicans in Congress do, which is, of course, you increase the debt limit, but try to package that with some elements of fiscal discipline so that you can start to make at least a little bit of incremental progress on the underlying solvency problems.
So, I mean, I don't disagree in the sense, I mean, I absolutely agree we've got to pay the debt, or we have to pay the bill. I think the idea that the only way you got President Obama and the Democrats in Congress to cut spending was by threatening the creditworthiness of the U.S. government, I think it's just not true. I mean, the one piece of inside information I will give you is President Obama really cares about the deficit. That, you know, if there is something that I noticed even in those first 2 years when the economic crisis had to be front and center, the thing he really wanted to deal with is that long-run deficit. And so the idea that he'll just go on a spending binge if you don't make threats like that, I think is crazy. I think the evidence is there that he has put spending cuts on the table. He kept asking for them to be paired with tax increases as well. But I think there's more goodwill, I guess, than I think people realize, and more agreement that we have got such a big budget problem that we're going to have to be firing on all cylinders. We're going to have to cut spending. We're going to have to reform our entitlement programs. And frankly, we're going to have to raise more revenue. And I think that is just the realistic, you know, situation when a problem is as big as we face.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speakers today are noted economic experts, Mr. Keith Hennessy and Dr. Christina Romer, who are discussing national, regional, and global economic challenges for 2013. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Now let's talk about, there's a series of questions around employment and job growth. What's your outlook on job growth, given we've been pretty stalled for a while here?
Well, I will start. I think, you know, I will say I was here last year, and I'm certainly more optimistic this year than last year. I think that, you know, we've made a significant amount of progress. If you look, you know, that looks like housing prices have finally started to turn the corner. I think if you look at households' balance sheets, we see that consumers have paid down a lot of that debt that was weighing on them. So I think there's reasons to be optimistic. I think that dynamism that I think we both embrace about the American market system is, I think, ready to kick in, take off, however you want to describe it. So I am fairly optimistic. I do think we still have some things weighing on it. So I think the concern about are we going to shoot ourselves in the foot and, you know, not raise the debt ceiling or not come to an agreement on various things, I think is one of the main things that could derail it. I am still, I think, more nervous about Europe than some people, precisely because though, you know, interest rates are down in some of the most troubled countries, their troubles are still there. So I don't think that's a problem that's gone away. So I think we do still have a risk to the economy. So unfortunately, I don't see us just, you know, heading off to robust, fast recovery. I think 2013 will be better than 2012. I wish I could tell you it'd be really, really good, because that's what we desperately need.
I'm not a forecaster. I don't even call myself an economist. I don't have a PhD in economics. I specialize in economic policy. So I've tried to be a good consumer of other forecasts. One thing that I've learned from that is, frankly, I don't trust any macro forecast that goes beyond 6 months, because I don't think anyone has any. I think they're just guessing beyond that. I think we probably, at least I would have similar reactions. I am still very concerned about the risks posed by Europe. I'm still quite concerned about the risk from an oil price shock, from things heating up in the Middle East. The U.S. economy is clearly, however, repairing itself. We don't have as significant a housing drag as we did a year or two ago. balance sheets are repairing. So, you know, yes, things seem to be headed in the right direction, but I also think that people often make the mistake of confusing the level for the growth rate. And I think we need to understand that even if the economy grows at 2 or 3% this year, which tends to sort of be the optimistic but realistic forecasters out there, you're still operating in a range of high unemployment. You're still operating with unemployment in the high sevens. And if our economic potential grows at about 3% per year and your actual output is growing at 3% per year, it means you're not going to close that output gap quickly enough. And one of the things, maybe now that you're back in academia, you can answer the question that I have still not found an economist who's been able to tell me why, in fact, recent recoveries have been so much slower than they seem to have been in the past. Now, this one's clearly different because it's resulting from a financial shock, but we don't seem to be getting the rapid upslope that you would hope in any case, and that's a real concern because it's just it's a pure loss.
I think you did answer the question. I think in large degree, the reason this recovery is so different is because this recession was so different. And precisely, you know, a typical recession, you know, say 1982, it was the Fed pushed up interest rates, really created a recession to try to get inflation down. And the nice thing is when you push up interest rates, you can lower interest rates. And then, you know, just as housing got crunched in the recession, as soon as you brought down those interest rates, it came flooding back. This is so different, right? We started from a housing bubble and bust. The Fed, you know, was already, you know, trying to help the economy. And then, right, we don't have sort of those natural drivers. So it has been this hard, long process of repairing balance sheets, getting people over the fear and the, you know, the uncertainty that was caused by living through something we hadn't lived through in 75 years. And I think that is a big part of why this has been slow coming out of this.
I would say probably my favorite economic policy word in that respect is flexibility. Is the more flexible your policy structure, the more flexible your economy is, then the more rapidly you can adjust to the shocks which are occurring. And that's part of why I'm almost always on the smaller government side, is I fear the added inflexibility that is created, the rigidities that are created by expansions of government, because they make it harder for managers of private firms to react when bad things happen, which they tend to happen.
We got a set of questions around regulation, and both of you mentioned a bit of that, in particular Dodd-Frank, and the fact that, you know, now it's been in existence, and lots of businesses, especially our financial institutions, have been grappling with how do you institute that. What's your outlook on really the effectiveness of being able to institute Dodd-Frank as it goes into, parts of it goes into law?
Well, I mean, I think it is an important step forward. I think, you know, this is one of those cases that, having lived through a financial crisis that was caused in part by financial innovation getting ahead of our regulatory structure, you sort of have no choice, but you come through it and you say, we have to fix our regulatory structure. I think it, and as I think is well known, sort of the biggest part of Dodd-Frank is actually not all the new regulations and things. It's largely, you know, higher capital requirements for banks, higher liquidity requirements for all financial institutions. And I think that makes sense. I think, again, that's kind of, that's basically, it's a market approach at some level to regulation. The best way to make sure that firms don't take, risks that we don't want them to take or that are potentially very damaging to the economy is to say you have to have skin in the game, right? So higher reserves, and you have to have plenty of liquidity to help make it through it. So I think, you know, that side of it, I think, is going to be very good, and we're phasing that in. You know, I do worry a lot of Dodd-Frank was left to be filled in. All the rulemaking is an arduous process. It's a slow process. It does create difficulties for businesses. And one of the things you do worry is it also is a time where rules can get weakened, or, you know, the basic principles are there, but the devil's in the details. And I do think we need to watch that, and I am somewhat concerned that maybe we're not going to be doing enough as we actually write those rules.
Dodd-Frank. Small topic. okay, so increased capital liquidity standards, good. Completely ignoring two of the largest financial institutions that are still SIFIs and still causing problems and have cost taxpayers hundreds of billions of dollars, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's just a big gaping hole. but I think the other thing is that the approach behind Dodd-Frank was higher capital and liquidity, rearrange the org chart. So there used to be a group called the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, which was the Treasury Secretary and the head of all the regulatory agencies. That group has, they've now added a couple different people to it, and they've called it the Systemic Risk Council. But it's pretty much the same people. They have slightly different tasks. And I don't see that that kind of org chart saying, okay, you smart group of people, you're now responsible for predicting and addressing and preventing systemic risk. I don't see that's going to do it. But my biggest concern with Dodd-Frank, there's a paper by Andrew Haldane of the Bank of England, a paper called The Dog and the Frisbee, which I would highly recommend. And it's about too big to fail institutions. And it basically is pointing to the approach that was taken in Dodd-Frank, which was higher capital and liquidity, which is good, but which is also saying, look, the problem of the 2008 financial crisis, this is the hypothesis, is that the regulators and supervisors didn't have enough information, they didn't have enough authority to do something about it, and then even when they didn't do something about it. So all we need to do is give the regulators and the supervisors more information, more power, and tell them to be more aggressive. And according to this hypothesis, that plus increased capital liquidity means that we don't have to worry about too big to fail institutions existing because they'll never fail. Because the government officials will be able to step in when an incompetent manager starts screwing things up. And even if they don't, there will be enough of a capital cushion to deal with it. And I just don't have the faith in government that they're going to actually be able to see it coming and they're going to be able to prevent it. And so the question is, we now have something like 24, I think about two dozen, what we call SIFIs, systemically important financial institutions, formerly known as too big to fail institutions. And we have created basically a structure around them that is like the structure that we had with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, where no one is willing to acknowledge that, in fact, there is an implicit government guarantee backing them. And we are all hoping that these institutions won't fail through some combination of competent management and government supervision. And I don't think that you actually have that combination. And so then what you're left with relying upon is the capital and liquidity cushions to hope that when one of these managers fouls up and when the regulators, not if, but when the regulators don't catch it in time, that there will be enough of a cushion so that you don't need to come in and do another bailout. The thing that I found most significant about this is one of the Federal Reserve governors, Dan Tarullo, who is the lead governor at the Fed for implementing the systemic risk provisions of Dodd-Frank. And he gave a speech back in October and said, basically, we don't know how to measure it. And we don't know how to do this. Congress, you guys are going to have to do it again. For the lead Fed governor, appointed by President Obama, who worked for President Clinton, to say, we don't know how to measure systemic risk and we don't know how to address it, when that was the core function of Dodd-Frank, I think the law has been a failure at addressing the underlying cause of the financial crisis.
See, Dr. Roemer's trying to say something on that point.
I took a quarter there, and I know I went long. But.
So, I mean, too big to fail is a huge issue, and I think something that I know I've heard you say before is, as a good free market economist, you're very nervous with just saying, let's, you know, shut down at a certain size or whatever, right? So it is a hard issue for which there isn't, you know, an obvious solution. I think you're selling Dodd-Frank too short in the following sense, which is besides the capital requirements and all of those things that are designed to prevent failures from happening, one of the parts was this idea of living wills, of financial institutions are supposed to, right, one of the things that the law tried to make clear is we're not going to go in and prop up a particular institution if it gets into trouble, that there has to be a way that it can be wound down that will not bring the system down. And I think that's one, if we can implement that and agree it's hard and whether banks will really do this, I think is an issue. But that was a piece of the legislation that we hope is going to be helpful.
I agree. And in concept, I fully support resolution authority. It's sometimes mm-hmm. called living wills. I think it's a great thing to try to do. I hope that it works. But the problem here is, the question is, are you comfortable having a financial system where you don't know whether the living wills are going to work, and you won't actually know whether they work until you get into the scenario where one of those where it's being tested. And in particular, what I come back, even if you assume that you can work it out domestically, right? Take one of these global financial institutions. Is this going to work globally? And what I think back to is Lehman and Barclays, right? Where Paulson, Bernanke, and Geithner were trying to get the British regulator to approve Barclays' purchase of Lehman, right? And the answer was, no, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to import your disease here. Even if you get all of the smart people at Treasury to negotiate international treaties and agreements on here's how we're going to make our living wills work across borders, if you actually get into the point where the financial system is on the brink again, I have no doubt that national regulators can do what their instincts are going to be, which is to put up firewalls and say, you know what, it's not my problem, you're going to take it. So I'm skeptical that they can make them work domestically. I'm really skeptical that they can make them work internationally, but I hope that they can.
We have a set of questions around healthcare, and I know that's definitely, you can't talk about the economy without talking about healthcare, whether in a global, national or local standpoint. Your views on healthcare, the impact of healthcare on the economy, and how do we make it really a positive impact versus a seemingly drag on the economy as we've had?
Well, we're getting into a pattern here. I'll start off. I mean, healthcare is a huge part of the economy. One of the questions people often ask about the first year of the Obama administration, why did you take on healthcare at the same time we were having all of these other issues? And I think precisely the reason was healthcare is not just a huge moral, social, technological issue. It's an economic issue. And it was one of those that we thought by helping to deal with that, it's something that can be helpful for the economy going forward. You know, if you ask how can it, what's a positive on healthcare? You ask, how's the economy doing? What's the sector in the economy that is growing, that's adding jobs, that was adding jobs through the whole recession? It's the healthcare sector of the economy. I think it is, and that's, I think, partly because it's a dynamic sector coming up with incredible innovations, the amount of exciting discoveries that are looming on the horizon, I think, are perhaps bigger in healthcare than in, so many parts of the economy. So that's the positive. The hard side is it's a complicated side. Precisely the reason we don't leave healthcare just to the private sector is because it's complicated. We don't look at someone who's on the street and in distress and say, sorry, you don't have health insurance, you should have bought it, and so too bad for you, right? We as a society are going to take care of that person. That inherently puts the government in this position. So I think we through the health reform legislation, I think it was an incredibly important step. I think it's a lot like Dodd-Frank in that the basic framework, I think, was sound. It had good, was in consultation with industry, with consumers, with doctors, and the devil's going to be in the details. We are in this very 2013 as an incredibly consequential year for how we actually ramp this thing up. All of the regulations that go in, the insurance exchanges so that people will have a place to buy insurance at the start of 2014, that's going to be a huge thing to be implementing over the next year. And it's one that the implementation has to be done well. I think that is incredibly important.
Okay, so my guess is probably every person in this room is spending a lot more on mobile telecommunication services than they did a decade ago. But we probably all think that that's worth it. In fact, we've all made that decision in our own lives that the added benefits of having a smartphone or an iPad or whatever are worth the added amount that we spend. On the healthcare side, you've got to make sure that you're defining the problem correctly. And on the healthcare side, what we have are unsustainable healthcare cost growth, which is driving three symptoms. It's driving slow growth in wages because employers are spending more of compensation increases on covering health insurance premiums and less on wage growth. Two is it has meant that there has been a large number of uninsured because as the product gets more expensive, fewer people can afford to buy it. And then third is that it's bankrupting state and federal governments. And so the problem, the way I would define it, is that the problem, and by the way, President Obama got this correct. He did not define the problem as we have too many uninsured. He defined the problem as unsustainable health care cost growth leading to all three of those symptoms. I wrote at the time, kudos to the president for diagnosing the problem correctly. And then I strongly disagreed with his solution, which was we're going to expand a government-financed benefit to a whole bunch of people and then hope that increased government intervention in private sector healthcare is in fact going to result in slowing cost growth. We got the expansion of access, or we're getting the expansion of access, by the way, mostly through Medicaid, even more than through private insurance. We've gotten that, and so those costs are now built into the system. What we have not got is any kind of certainty that, in fact, healthcare cost growth is going to slow. And, in fact, what history suggests is that the more you move the payment for medical goods and services to a third party, the more that gets spent. This has been true with the creation of Medicare and Medicaid. It clearly helped the people who are enrolled in those programs, but it also increased both the level and the growth rate of spending, and it's true in private insurance as well. So my fear here is that we've expanded access, but if anything, we've probably exacerbated the unsustainable growth in per capita health care. I happen to think that instead the way to go is to push the decisions more to the people who are, in fact, receiving the goods and services. It's to move more toward consumer-directed health care, initially for routine services, and then people can start to make trade-offs and figure out, am I, in fact, getting good value for the dollar that's spent? Is this additional test worth the cost? Because that's what you really want. You don't want more spending or less spending. You want high-value spending. You want to be saying, I'm getting a lot of health benefit for this dollar.
But given the way our system is set up, the consumers tend to want more and more, right? Especially we talked about innovation in healthcare. All that innovation does have a potential impact of actually driving costs up, not down.
Absolutely. And I think this is an area where we agree, which is that while there are tremendous inefficiencies in the system and there's a disagreement as to whether pushing the decisions more to government or more toward individuals is going to reduce the level of spending, the principal driver of the growth in healthcare spending is the adoption of new, we're consuming more and better healthcare. The new drugs are making lots of our lives better, but it also means that we're spending more, just as we're spending more on smartphone services.
I love taking the president absolutely, as part of healthcare reform, made the containment of costs a big part of the legislation. He was always very clear. There were two parts. There was the expanded access that he thought that was the moral issue, the social issue. That was also a labor productivity issue. I mean, one of the things I did at the Council of Economic Advisors was a study looking at the economic case for doing healthcare reform. And part of, making sure everyone has access to healthcare is you have a healthier labor force. You have workers who don't stay in a job that isn't a good fit because it happens to provide health insurance and they have a pre-existing condition, right? And so there's an economic reason even for the increase in access. On the cost containment, again, we're going to have to see how this plays out. It is another one of these grand experiments. We don't have a lot of, how do we slow the growth in healthcare costs? No country has figured this out, and it's something we're all struggling with. What the health reform legislation did do, it had two things I think Keith should like, right? One is certainly this consumer-directed health and, that making consumers, have to make decisions. One of the things that was very controversial was putting a tax on high-priced insurance plans, precisely because high-priced insurance plans tend to have very few deductibles and no co-payments, and so it insulates consumers from their choices. And so one of the hardest sells for a Democrat was to say, let's put a tax on those really high-priced plans to try to make sure that we still have some consumer choice. So I think that is consumer decision making. So I think that's important. The other thing that the legislation did is to basically say, let's just try a bunch of experiments, that we have the Medicare program. Let's try, doctors will tell you organizing things by fee for service is a way to encourage more, more services and not necessarily better care. So let's try bundling payments and not pay the anesthesiologist and the surgeon and the nurse and the hospital, but to say, you're having a knee replacement, here's the money, you guys figure out how to get that patient well and out and walking again as fast as possible and make sure they don't come back to the hospital with an infection. I think those kinds of experiments are, one way we can try to figure out what will work. So it's kind of this mixture of more market incentives and the bold experimentation to figure out what might work.
I get fired up about this.
Okay. So do I.
This could be a two-day conversation.
Totally agree on the taxation of the employer-provided exclusion. And in fact, when I worked for President Bush, he proposed repealing that exclusion. And replacing it with a standard deduction that did not create the incentives to continue to have compensation shift more and more toward health insurance. Absolutely. And it was organized labor opposition on the left that basically forced the legislation only to tax extremely costly plans. So I agree there. Let me link this to the broader fiscal question of entitlement spending. So the argument that was made in 2009 was by the administration was, yes, we have growth in the major entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Okay? We agree there. Second point, that growth is all about health care costs. You don't need to worry about Social Security or demographics because if you look out to 2050, health care cost growth dominates. Well, first of all, that's great if you actually think you're going to make it to 2050, but we're not. And, in fact, over the next 15 to 20 years, demographics is a bigger driver of our spending growth than healthcare cost growth. But that argument was used by the administration to take Social Security out of the entitlement discussion. Okay, now we're focused on healthcare cost growth. Well, what's the solution? The solution that was proposed was to expand access to taxpayer-subsidized insurance and then to try a set of experiments that might allow the government to figure out ways to reduce the number of services that each person is using. Okay? The increased costs are definitely going to occur. Those are locked into law, and it would be extremely difficult for anyone now to come in and undo them. So we've added in the certain cost growth for the federal government. We now have three big health care entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, and the new Affordable Care Act subsidies. But on the other side, if we thought those experiments were going to work, then we would expect the government actuaries to be lowering their forecast for government health care costs. And they haven't. If you look at what the government actuaries are now saying will happen about federal health care spending, the problem is just as bad or even worse as it was before the law was enacted. So what we were told was, you don't have to fix Social Security. The Affordable Care Act will fix our government health spending problem. Now we fix that, and they're saying, well, we haven't done it, so now we need to do some other unspecified health care reforms. That's a problem.
All right. First of all, no one ever said we never had to do anything about Social Security. I think where the description has always been is that the problems in Social Security are more manageable, that it has a deficit if you look over the next, 75 years or the common window, but that reasonably sensible changes that we could understand could deal with that one. And I think there's a lot of support. If you look in the Bowles-Simpson bipartisan proposal, I think people say, yes, we should certainly deal with that. The Affordable Care Act was never supposed to solve all of our entitlement programs. It was always a mixture of, we do have a problem that we have 40 million Americans who don't have health insurance, who don't have the necessary access to health care, and we want to deal with that problem. And what the president promised is that he would do it in a way that didn't increase the budget deficit by a dime. And he did that both by raising some revenues, by cutting other kinds of spending, so parts of Medicare and Medicaid that he thought were not efficient and could be dialed back, and by putting in these measures that we thought would help to slow the growth rate of healthcare costs over time. Now, what the Medicare actuaries are projecting. I mean, one of the most important things is at the time the administration was doing this, the Congressional Budget Office looked at what we were doing. One of the most important things is they said, you've got to have something like the tax on high price plans or we're not going to say it's going to be a sensible, fiscally responsible thing to do. And so that legislation very much was geared towards slowing the growth rate of costs. And the experts certainly at the time were saying, it looks as though we think they're doing the kinds of things that could make a difference.
Okay, but there's a technical important point here. There's a difference between reducing the deficit and slowing government health care spending.
Of course.
Right? If we set aside all the debates about whether CBO got their scoring correct, and we take as a given that CBO scoring is what the referee says, what CBO said was that the bill reduces the deficit. They did not say that it slows health spending or it reduces health spending. In fact, it reduces the deficit even though it increases government health spending and it reduces the deficit because it's got tax increases that are bigger than the increases in spending growth. So to the extent that our medium and long-term problem is driven by demographics and the growth of healthcare spending, the law has made the second of those worse.
I think that that's not, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's no question that we expanded coverage to millions of Americans. I think the number was 32 million people will have health insurance that didn't have it before. That obviously is not free, right? That comes at a cost. Everyone understood that that came with a cost. It was paid for in part by tax increases and in part by cuts in other health, government health care spending. So it was not all on the revenue side. The other thing I think that's so important is that the Congressional Budget Office not only said it reduced the deficit in the first decade, which is what they usually look at, but they actually said, and if you look out in the second decade, we think it will reduce the deficit even more. So I think they were, in fact, giving credit and thinking that it would slow the growth rate of some of the health care spending. So I think that I think, is an important point.
Let's switch to another passionate topic, education. We had quite a few questions from the audience on how much can we afford to fund and where should we be funding and investing in the educational system, and also comment on whether it's really done at a national level or a state level that we should be focused on in terms of funding.
Let's mix it up. You go first.
I've read that that test scores of American elementary and secondary educational students have not increased since the famous Nation at Risk report in the early 80s, even though real per capita spending on education has increased dramatically. So I question whether the solution to the problem is let's take our elementary and secondary educational system and pour even more money into it. It's hard to argue against let's spend more money because that can't possibly hurt. But it seems to me that you basically have major structural flaws in the way the system is organized and that it's not producing the results that we need. And I strongly believe that this, I would say, after entitlement spending, I would put the poor quality of our elementary and secondary educational outcomes as the greatest long-term threat to America's economic strength. I think it's the most important thing, and I think it has to do with structural flaws that are largely tied to having a system that is, you know, still modeled after the one-room schoolhouse of the 19th century.
But more investment and more spending is not your...
I don't think that's the solution. Look, I think the teachers' unions are preventing the kinds of innovations and experimentation that you need to figure out how to, in fact, improve educational outcomes. And I think that they are incredibly effective at doing that at the local, the state, and the federal level. What's fascinating is when I talk to or read a bunch of the education reformers, and they all sit around arguing, and the arguments all go like this. Well, if I didn't have the teachers' unions preventing me from doing my reform, here's what I'd do, and it would fix the system. And you have three reformers, and they all sit around, and they all begin with exactly that same premise. If the teachers' unions were not preventing me from doing my reform, then my reform would work. And they all argue about whether whose reform is better. But they all start with the same thing, which is that none of them can compete on their ideas because they all face the same hurdle. I don't think we know which of these structural reforms is actually the one that's going to lead to better outcomes. I think we do know that none of that experimentation is being allowed because of the stagnation in the system, and it's holding everybody back.
Dr. Romer?
One place it is being allowed, in fact, even encouraged, is through some of the programs that President Obama put in with the Recovery Act and then has tried to continue the race for the top program. So when we were designing the Recovery Act, one of his priorities was, listen, we're spending all this money, let's do things, you know, to help the economy in the short run, but let's also do things that are good for the long run health. And we did a bunch of money just to state and local governments to say, you're in trouble, so you don't cut services, so you don't cut education, here's some money. But a chunk of it was held back for the Race for the Top program, which was precisely a competitive grant program. And one of the key parts is, rather than viewing the teachers' union as an adversary, can a community get the union and the administration and the parents all together with a proposal? And if they could come up with something, they got government money. And I think that maybe is a model for how, rather than just demonizing the teachers' union, to actually say, how do you bring them in to work together? On the government spending, I think one of the places where the economic evidence is probably the strongest is on the value of spending at very young ages. And some of the research coming out of the University of Chicago, not usually a hotbed of liberal ideas, especially on the economic side, of investments in really young children, those interventions done when they're 1, 2, 3 years old, do seem to have real value, even, you know, in test scores and graduation rates and all those things down the line. So I think that's one place I would definitely be looking for spending more money. And even in tough budgetary times, you don't cut everything. You say, where's the good money to spend?
So focus on preschool and early education.
Even earlier interventions of, you know, get the at-risk mothers when they're pregnant and work with them and when the children are infants, you know, teaching them better how to nurture their children so that they can succeed in school.
Thanks. Let's spend a minute talking about the California economy. Mm-hmm. Is Governor Brown doing a good job with our economy, and are we stabilized now in terms of the economy and poised for growth?
You're going to have to do this one.
I guess there's no debate on this one.
I mean, I think Governor Brown has done a remarkable job, that this was the California economy was hit very hard by the recession, precisely. We had a big collapse in our house prices. We have state revenues that are very sensitive to the state of the state economy. And so California, you know, I can tell you when I was in the government, you know, the number of times I said, we have full faith that California will deal with its problems because, God, we were praying that California would deal with its problems. But it was a state that was in grave distress. The change that we have seen over the last 4 years, I think, has been incredibly positive. You know, the state is still in trouble. Our unemployment rate is still close to 10%, so it's not in any sense that we're out of the woods. But what is, I think, so remarkable is the degree to which the governor was able to cut spending. I mean, believe me, being at the University of California, we know that spending got cut. We saw it every single day. But he made the case to voters. He said, I'm willing to cut spending. Here's the next set of spending I'm going to cut. And my question for you is, do you want me to cut that spending or do you want me to raise your taxes? And I think it is remarkable both the degree to which he explained that to the voters and the degree to which the voters said, we're willing to tax ourselves for 7 more years because we don't want those state services cut. And I think that has been a remarkable achievement. And the idea that the state that was a fiscal basket case 4 years ago is looking at balanced budgets going forward, I think, is really important, and I give the governor a lot of credit.
I'm not well qualified to comment on the California-specific questions, so just briefly, there's a very useful sort of lesson here, which is that we should care about at both the state and the federal level. We should care about the deficit. We should care about the difference between what a government is spending and what the government's collecting in revenues. It's extremely important. We should also care about the size of government. We should care about both. And what we've done over the past several years is we have eliminated concerns about the deficit. We've done that to a large extent by increasing the size of government and the tax burden. And the bigger government is, the fewer resources there are for California families and California businesses to do what they want to do with them. And so you've got to take both of those into account. And I think that one of my concerns is if we simply say, look, deficits aren't a problem, everything is better, what we're ignoring is that other dimension, because in reality what happens is policymakers are making two decisions. One is when they're deciding about deficits or surpluses, they're allocating resources over time. They're deciding, are we going to borrow from our state's future income? But two, when they make decisions on the size of government, they are allocating resources between the public and private sector, and they're making decisions about how efficient the state economy is and how much it's going to grow. But I can't answer on the specifics of sort of California future GDP growth path.
Well, I just wanted to say that I feel the remarkable thing is the degree to which the California voters said, we have a view about what size of government we want. And there are services that we don't want to see cut, like education, like some of our social services, and so we're willing to tax ourselves. And that's surely the right way to make these decisions, is to let the voters decide.
I can't resist. Yeah, but they didn't decide to tax themselves. They decided to tax those five really rich guys over in the corner.
As a collective group, that's what was decided. Well, unfortunately, we reached a point in our program where there's only time for one last question. So I think this question both of you may be in agreement on, but I'm not sure. Given we're having lunch in San Francisco, and it's been an exciting time for us as it relates to the 49ers, I'm going to ask you your outlook on who's going to win the Super Bowl here. I'll let the ladies first here.
Well, I will not. This is one where I definitely will not claim to be an expert. So I will not vote with my head, but completely with my heart, which is I'm going to think the 49ers are going to win because I want them to win.
Mr. Hennessy.
Stanford will again beat Cal.
Fair.
You're sitting between two Cal folks here.
I got to go last. And again, make it to a BCS bowl game. Let's hear it for David Shaw. And Niners by 10 points.
Okay. Well, on that note, our thanks to Mr. Keith Hennessy, lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and Stanford Law School, and former director of the National Economic Council under President George W. Bush, and Dr. Christina Romer, professor of economics at the University of California at Berkeley, and the former chair of the President Obama's Council of Economic Advisor. And special thanks to everyone here in our audience, as well as on the radio and television. This program has been sponsored by the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America. I'm Anna Mock, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth of California, the place where you're in the know, is officially adjourned.